Osiris.
Here we are. See that? That makes it live. Thanks, Brian. Brian is telling me that we're live. Speaking of hands, we have an extra set of hands here today to help us out. Matt Dwyer is with us,
hey.
And he has his own set of hands as well. Hey, Matt.
Hello. You got it. Hutch. Fans in the front row.
Can it hold my drink?
we can do it. Just try it. Just leave it hanging there. Anyway, Matt, I got to give you a hand for joining us today. Thank you so much. how are you guys doing today?
Great. Just got back.
Matt...
I got back from the dentist, so I'm very clean right now. Doing great.
I think Matt's going to come in handy today. I'm really excited about this episode.
You know, Brian and I had a long exchange about the dentist on the show last week because I had to go to the dentist and get two things replaced, and they had to like numb my mouth, and then the dentist was like pushing on my tooth, like really hard to try to like push in the thing or something, and it was just bad. But we learned that Matt is not afraid of the dentist like Brian and I are.
Not afraid, but I don't like it that much. I've considered doing one of those sedation dentistry things where they give you nitrous every time. But that's also expensive.
You just go to Happy Land.
I just kind of, yeah, they just give you nitrous, which, you know, is fun. I've been told. You get to just zonk out and maybe listen to some tunes or something and, you know, get your teeth cleaned.
Yeah.
This is a safe space for this kind of dialogue, right? I always attribute my first psychedelic experience to the dentist. I was getting a root canal when I was like 13 years old. I chipped my tooth and the nerve died, and they put the laughing gas on me and left the room, and there was like emergency dental surgery that came in, and they just left me sitting there for like 45 minutes, and I was just like breathing this in. They come back like, oh my God, he's still here. He's still got the thing on his nose. And they put me back, and they like put in the Novocaine still because they still got to numb everything. And I'm getting surgery, and John Lennon's Imagine came on, and I was like, I am just floating in space right now. This is it. And 5-6 years later in my life, I was like, oh, I remember what that was. That was an important moment in my life.
That is amazing. Wow.
I don't know where we go from here. That was too good.
It's too good.
I guess hurts before we get into this, you know, Brian and I have been going through live tracks. This is our 7th edition. And Matt, you are joining us for a New Year's Eve show from 1996 from Hampton, Virginia. And, before I ask you a couple of questions, I just want to say, if you're watching or listening and you like what we're doing here, share the show with your friends. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get podcasts. Help us reach some more people. And also, I have to give a plug for a show that we're doing next Monday in Ardmore, here outside of Philly, before the Man shows. We're going to have Tom Hamilton, Chris Forsyth, and Daniel Donato as our three musical guests. I'm going to interview them, and then they're going to play with the house band, who's also amazing. And then there's going to be a super jam. And Matt, you were at the last one.
Yeah.
The super jam is pretty sweet, or it was last time. I assume it's going to be maybe even cooler this time.
Yeah, the super jam was great. Although I have to say, people usually look forward to these super jams the most because it's like, oh, I've got, you know, different people I've never seen playing together or whatever. But I actually enjoyed the individual segments last time with the artists playing, you know, some of their own music or playing some cool covers. You know, Aaron Magner played Goodbye Stranger from Supertramp, and Brownie did some Bob Marley, right? Those were really, really fun because it's an opportunity for them kind of outside of their typical band to just be like, you know what, we let them pick like whatever song they wanted to play. And sometimes you're into a song and you want your band to play it and you get crickets. I just sent a song to our band text thread the other day a suggestion that I thought was amazing, and nobody even responded to me. So the chances of us playing that are, but if I were, you know, famous and I was going to be on stage in Ardmore, I'd be like, God damn it. We're playing, what the hell is the song called? Fortress Around Your Heart. Is that what it's called? Yeah.
Okay. So, well, okay. That's a good point. That's a good point. And hearing when they played Goodbye Stranger with the backing band, the sound check for that, I think, was way more intense than Aaron was anticipating. Remember, they went through it like 100 times. Yeah. Turns out that song's like very complicated, but it turned out great. There's a link on the screen if you're watching. But if you're listening, go to osirispod.com/osirislive. Join us next Monday. We have other shows as well, and there's more to be announced. So we'd love to see you out somewhere. Matt, what is your brief and illustrious history with Dave Matthews Band?
The quick way to say it is I was a pretty big fan in the late 90s. Before I got into Phish, I got into DMB. They were sort of the gateway into, live improvised music, as I think they were for a lot of people around our general age. And then, you know, I think about 25 shows, something like that. And then they started to do less and less of what I liked about them and more of things that were, I found it, you know, kind of annoying. And at the same time, I had gotten into Phish and they were kind of hitting all the right buttons for me. So the last time that I saw Dave Matthews Band was at Bonnaroo in 2005. And that, I think it's different now, but back then Bonnaroo, like when the headliner was playing, they were the only one that was on. All the other stages were dark. So we went over and I took a nap during their show. I just laid down in the field and slept and got energized for late night. So it was cool, actually. Well, I mean, we're going to talk about this, but like diving back in and listening to this show was actually pretty cool experience, because I haven't listened to DMB intentionally in a very, very long time. So it kind of, you know, brought some old memories and stuff out that I'm stoked to talk about today.
Nice.
Interesting, as we've gone through this, like a lot of the listeners who've commented throughout the episodes have talked about 2005 being, in their opinion, the low point of Dave's career. I wonder, like, because I've always wondered this. The last Dave Matthews show I saw was in 2001, and it was the Everyday Tour. And yeah. I was kind of just like, even though Phish is on hiatus right now, I'm kind of checked out. This just isn't where my musical interests are going. And I've always heard that that's a low point from a fan perspective as well. I wonder if my last show or if your last show had been at a higher point in the band's history, would I still be doing this? Would I not be just like getting back into the band at this point in time? I don't really know. It's kind of, it's been the interesting aspect of diving into these shows.
Well, that was, and I, you know, since I took a nap, I obviously was not at Bonnaroo to see Dave Matthews Band. Yeah. And my last show before that had been 2002. And I also, I mean, just to, you know, not bury the lead, every day was really the turning point for me, and I think for a lot of people, that, you know, I saw them, you know, probably like their three night stand in Camden in 2001 and 2002, and just like not good. That's what I was talking, like they were playing these poppy songs that I didn't like. The songs that were on the Lily White sessions that I loved were not getting played as much, and it just was at that point turning into, you know, my first show in 98 was like, you know, I think like 3.5 hours long or something like that. And like tons of big jams. And, you know, by the time I saw them the last time, I think they played for like an hour and 45 minutes, no jams. You know, you were going to get like Crash and Satellite and all that kind of stuff that I really didn't want to hear. So that I think it was that whole decline, you know, in the first part of the aughts when every day kind of screwed everything up. About every day, the story about that was always that this guy from the record label, Bruce Floor, was the one who told Dave to shelve all of the Lily White session stuff and move in this poppier direction, make an album with Glenn Ballard, who was writing like, you know, mega pop hits and stuff like that. I never realized this. We found this out during the making of Alive Again. He was also one of the people who was in Trazier in 2005, and basically it was like, you need to break up Tab and you need to work with Rick Beato and all these like studio musicians and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, fuck that guy.
Yeah. Let's get him on the show and like really ask him some serious questions about why he tried to ruin Dave and Trey's career. Come on, dude.
Yeah. If you don't mind, I know I'm hogging the mic here, but I just remembered actually a very, very funny tidbit about my DMB history. And I was a really active fan. I mean, I was on the, you know, the news group and chatting with a lot of people, meeting up at shows and stuff like that. I was actually one of the people, and I think the statute of limitations is out on this. I was actually one of the people that was like very, very responsible for getting the Lily White Sessions out there. Cause I was a freshman in college, or maybe a sophomore, And I had this like extremely fast internet connection in my dorm. Like even like by 2001 standards or whatever, this was like a blazing fast internet. And I knew how to set up like FTP servers and stuff like that. So the short version of the story is like the guy who got the leak, like didn't know what he was doing. But he got the CD to somebody who then sent me and like one other person, the FLAC or shortened files or whatever. And I seeded the Lily White Sessions to like tens of thousands of people over the course of like a week. And then I lost my internet privileges for the rest of the semester.
That's awesome.
Well, so. I may or may not have gotten one of those copies, and I thank you for it. I got that in the spring of 2001, and it was on constantly. I think that was one of the burned CDs that like I got so many skips in because I played it so much that like you looked on the other side and it was just like lines going around.
Yeah. Yeah.
So guys, we're talking about this show at Hampton Coliseum. As Robbie points out, this is the last DMB New Year's Eve show. I wonder why they stopped playing New Year's Eve, but Brian, I think we all know about the Hampton Coliseum, but is there anything that you want to share with us before we start talking about music?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is the mothership. This is one of the most famous venues. Grateful Dead, Phish play there each 21 times. First pay-per-view rock show was filmed there in 81. The Rolling Stones played it. Keith Richards famously hits a fan who jumps on stage at that point in time. But I was looking around at just what was happening at the end of 1996. This is like Jerry Maguire time in America. This is Cuba Gooding Jr., Tom Cruise comeback. This is Renee Zellweger. This is like that movie is everywhere in America right now, which really defines like the mid 90s to me. Like that movie feels like 1996 and features a song on its soundtrack from an artist that we're going to talk about very, very soon. Hint, hint, hint. I think just like moving into this overall release and where the band was, you can really hear it in Dave's in between song, like the way he's talking to the crowd, the way he's talking to the band, the way he's celebrating the end of 1996. There's an argument to be made that this is the biggest year of the band's career, and that when they went into 1996 versus when they come out, they're like two different bands. They release this album Crash. It's their biggest album to date at that point in time. It's got huge singles. Crash Into Me is, I think, the biggest single that the band has released throughout their overall career. Ultimately, they come out of this being able to play arenas, amphitheaters with regularity and being probably, you know, being one of the biggest touring acts of the 1990s. And you can really, really hear in the overall show, just like the appreciation that they have for the fans who have stuck with them, who've been there with them. We talked last week about the crash release party show from 4/30/96 and how that felt like a band that had achieved so much. It was now playing in Richmond, was playing for their larger fan base in a way that was like almost kind of saying goodbye to this period of their career, and they were entering something unknown and something new. And they throw this huge party for everyone at Hampton. It's the last two set show that Dave Matthews Band would play, which is a format that like, I'll kind of just come out and say it. I don't know if it necessarily changes the dynamic of things. We've talked about this a bit throughout the overall series here. personally, I don't think it really changes like the dynamic of how a Dave Matthews Band show flows. But it also showcases the Flecktones as being just like a perfect companion piece.
Check something real quick before somebody in the chat does, because we always have to be right.
We do.
Didn't they do a tour like 10 years ago or something where they played two set shows?
They did. As I was reading through this, and part of the reason I put this in here is that those shows were specifically an acoustic show and then acoustic set and an electric set. So yes, technically two sets. This was kind of the last, like, we're going to play two defined sets of music at this point.
Yeah. I get that. I think it's also important delineation of when they started to sort of branch off from like the mid 90s jam scene, which was built around that two set structure.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, it's wild that like this show still kind of flows like a Dave Matthews show, and the break that happens over midnight. They go off stage, they come back on stage right as the clock is ticking down for 1997, which gives it like, I guess this show probably started at like 9:30 at night, something like that. I don't know. I'm curious your guys' thoughts just in terms of like where the band was at this point in time, where they're going, as well as, you know, we've talked a lot about guest appearances on the show and the impact that they have on them. What do you guys think in terms of where the band is at now?
I mean, I guess to me, it's like, you know, how do I say this? It all kinds of sounds the same to me. So I'm not really sure. Like, it's like, I don't notice that much of a difference except in the material itself and the guests, you know, like this show starts with like four almost 10 minute tracks, you know, and they're like stretched out and it sounds great. I think it's really fun. Like, you know, first 45 minutes of the show. I wouldn't differentiate it that much between maybe with the 04 or 06 shows we talked about, but in terms of these other shows around the same era, they sound like they're kind of in the same place to me.
Yeah. I mean, I think Brian, like you said, this was, if it wasn't their biggest, the biggest point in their career, it was kind of the beginning of that point. I think from like 96 through 2000 was, you know, when I was seeing shows, they were huge. I'm going to probably bring up throughout our conversation today a number of times. One of the things that I've been thinking about a lot since I listened to the show last week is kind of 90s nostalgia and putting myself back into looking at like the 90s culture from outside and inside, because I really wasn't a DMB fan until 98. I saw my first show then, but it was like, you know, everybody knew who they were. They were all over MTV and the radio. And I thought they were good. I liked their jazzier stuff, but you know, there was also this cultural thing of like, if you were a white kid in the suburbs of the United States and went to high school in the 1990s, like this was like a rite of passage, going to the Dave show in the summer, drinking underage, trying a little bit of the weed, and you know, telling your friends what an epic time it was. I mean, I listened to the show with my wife. She's 5 years older than me, and she immediately was like, oh yeah, that time at Walnut Creek when we did XYZ. And so I think that there's something very kind of, now that I think about it, endearing about that, and looking back at the culture and the way that they stood for some aspect of US, you know, cult, you know, teenage culture at that point. And I think this is 96 around, you know, this is when they were really, really, you know, kind of peaking in that way as this, you know, cultural touchstone. So it's kind of cool to look back at them. There really wasn't at this point much of this kind of like, you know, DMB is like lame or cringy or whatever like that. Like they were really just like a very, very popular band that people really loved. And it's nice to step back into that place and time.
It's interesting because like they also still kind of feel to me at this point, like this is the end of the biggest year of their career to this point in time, but they still feel like that little band that's trying to make it. I mean, they're 5 years, they're at the end of their fifth year of a band. We've talked about this, like the overall arc of their career. It's so wild how early, they catch on and they become this kind of cultural cachet. And it must be sometime around 95, 96 that it becomes this touchstone that you have to go through. That, like, if you're in high school and you like music and you're starting to get interested in, okay, what's possible with music beyond a 3-minute song, you're interested in trying weed at that point. You're interested in hanging out with people who are drinking. Like, there's all these like elements that prove by like 96, 97, 98 to be, if you're going in this direction with your friend group, with your life, like, this is a path you're going to go down. And this band feels like that bigness of like attracting people is just starting to come to them here.
Yeah. Yeah. That, and the nostalgia point is interesting. I hadn't really thought about that, but going back, it's sort of a lot of stuff is brought back. I think to me, like, the quality of Dave's writing is really stands the test of time, you know, even though like some of those songs ended up being like so overplayed or, you know, you got tired of hearing them. They're now going back to them. It's like, wow, he writes a great love song, particularly. Brian, I think this is a good way to get into this, is the first kind of like conclusion or theme that you had from this show.
Yeah, I was thinking about this in conjunction with what we've talked about throughout this series. And so we're 7 volumes into Dave Matthews Band's career. I think that 5 of these 7 have featured a special guest. I think the only shows that did not were Live Tracks 3 from Hartford 2000 and possibly that Crash Release Party. I think that was just Dave Matthews Band, but everything else has featured either additional members or special guests. And really notably, Live Tracks 1, fantastic show from 12/8/98, which that year really signifies like the best of the Dave Matthews Band sound to me at this point. And this show feature the Flecktones, feature Bela Fleck, and then this is the entire Flecktones for most of the second half. This album, this show also features Paul McCandless, who joins the band as well during the shows. But it made me think, like, I was thinking about this yesterday. Why do special guests seem to always make Dave Matthews Band better? Why is it that my wife and I were listening to this show, we were taking the kids hiking, and they play Number 41, my favorite Dave Matthews song, and Bela Fleck comes on and puts an incredible banjo solo into the end of it. And it just adds so much to an already great song. And it made me wonder, like, does this band, I'm curious your guys' thoughts, does this band need someone else to elevate their already great songs in the live setting? Like, or is it just, I don't know. I don't really answer this because, like, you know, we make the Dead comparisons all the time. You want to hear the Dead play the Dead songs. You want to hear them take those songs to a different level. You want to hear Trey play his songs. But with Dave Matthews Band, I kind of want to hear Bela Fleck add his touches to it. I'm curious your guys' thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think a couple things. So first off, I think back then, and still it's true, I'm contradicting myself because it's like one of the stories of the summer is, you know, people sitting in with other bands, right? That was always kind of one of those cool jam band, like, oh, you know, we were talking about the super jam before, right? Everybody likes
totally
cross pollination. In the case of DMB, the Flecktones have almost been kind of like a sister band to Dave Matthews Band, you know, because of the amount of time they spent touring with them, playing with them. You know, Jeff Coffin is now in the Dave Matthews Band. I think there was a lot of like just kind of, you know, partnership relationship. And I think their sounds really work well together. Like, as much as I love hearing Bela Fleck play with Fish, it's a very, very big departure and it alters Fish's sound significantly if he does that. Whereas like a banjo plugs into the Dave Matthews Band like very, very nicely. And I think they recognize that early on and took advantage of it. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, like the guitarist we've heard on here, Tim Reynolds, and that other guy whose name now I forget, that we talked about last week, both. What was that guy's name, Brian? Do you remember?
David, I'll pull it up here.
Sorry, you don't have to, but you know who I'm talking about. I think the electric guitar like is kind of missing from their sound once I hear a guitarist in the band. And then like, you know, the Butch Taylor, the piano, I mean, it always like enhances it. And maybe that's just because we're used to hearing it just as like the main musicians that we're used to. But I kind of think they do always make it the shows more interesting and better.
It kind of makes me wonder, like, I think about like Carter and Leroy's backgrounds. It almost makes me wonder if like Dave Matthews Band is like the perfect template for a band to, for like a musician to come in and add their flavor to it. And that is this like ongoing push and pull of like, why, like Matt, I didn't see as many shows as you, but I was very similar in terms of like my timeline of like when I was like, okay, I'm off, I'm going to different bands, because Dave Matthews Band kind of sometimes feels like it's a standard template of like, this is a really good rock performance. Like this is a really good live performance, but it needs something more to elevate it. And this show to me proves they're all great songs. They're all great performances, but then you add a guest and it just adds something more to make it really special.
Yeah. I think the other part to be, you know, I'm going to try not to be too critical of them on this discussion, because I really did enjoy listening to this show, but
totally,
you know, one of the things that kind of drove me away from them was that the songs themselves became very kind of like templatized, right? I mean, like you could see like, yeah, no, I mean, even in this period, they were a little bit more interesting, but like, yeah, they could go 30 minutes deep on number 41 with the entire Flecktones on stage, but they did it the same exact way every time, right? Each person right. took a solo, and then they went into the Sojourn of Arjuna thing, and they do that, and then they bring it back. And I think that with DMB, guests are a way to kind of break that mold up, right? I mean, like you can play Lie in Our Graves and, you know, Boyd can take a solo for the 1,000th time, or you can have Trey Anastasio or Eric Krasno step on stage and rip a guitar solo, and it's something different. It's something notable about the show. In a case where they wouldn't normally have something like a Type 2 jam that's like very, very unique to that night. So I remember in my time listening to the band, always loving guests, being really stoked for guests, but also, RJ, to your point, always wanting Tim Reynolds to be in the band, to add his sound, which ironically, I feel like this was the period of time where he actually kind of like sat in with them the least, like after 96, like in the late 90s, he really didn't play with them that much. And then my understanding is in recent years, he's become more of a, you know, standard member of the band. But like my first show, summer of 98, there were a bunch of guests that show. Greg Howard sat in and some other people. But like my second show was that fall tour when like the Flecktones opened and Tim Reynolds was there on guitar. And I mean, that was just epic. I mean, just like the first hour was like Seek Up into a jam, into Talanaga Pampa, into Rapunzel, and like, you know, just insane stuff.
Yeah,
that's the magic. I think this leads really nicely into your first theme, RJ, which I think like I was listening to the highlights I plucked from this volume this morning with this in mind, and it kind of blew my mind. You want to go through it?
Sure. Yeah, and I want to just thanks everybody for your comments, and I just want to say Galaxy Jams, who's watching and commenting. I went on their show last night, and they introduced me to some new music that I had never heard before, so check them out on Twitch. Yeah, I guess I was just thinking with Bela Fleck sitting in, and as we've been listening to this, and the lack of a guitarist on most of the music, like, are they more of a bluegrass band than a rock band, or are they more of a rock band, or is what makes them unique and different that they don't fall into any category? Because I'm not sure that they're like a rock band. What do you guys think?
I don't think you can call them a straight rock band. I think that they fall into this very strange middle ground, which has been both to their benefit and to their detriment. I was thinking about it when Dave sat in with Fish at in Mexico this past year. They play The Maker, which is like, you know, it's a cover from Daniel Lanois. It's like the perfect sound for Dave Matthews Band. It's a little bit slow. It's really beautiful melody. It allows his voice to find a lot of range, but allows the backing band to like add a bunch of like ideas and thoughts. And then they play Tweezer Reprise. And my immediate first thought was, this is the hardest that Dave has ever played on stage. Like, he doesn't know how to totally do this because this is like harder than he's ever played. And like Tweezer Reprise, we call it in the Phish world, like the greatest 3 minutes in rock. It is as like straight ahead of a rock song as possible. And it's something that like Phish kind of has in droves. And Dave Matthews Band like doesn't have a song like this. Like they have a lot of songs like beautiful ideas and like rocking moments, but like they don't have a song that's like just a straight rock song for you. So I kind of think they're in this like weird middle ground that's a challenge for them. What do you think, Matt?
Yeah, that they're definitely not a rock band, and they're definitely not a bluegrass band. They're not even close to being a bluegrass band. They have banjo when Bela sits in, but I don't think they're close to that at all. I think the benefit that they've had that they will ultimately be remembered for in the long run, that they'll be written about historically, that will be when they make it into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, will be one of the things that they're sort of, you know, applauded for, is this eclectic sound that they created. There really wasn't much like it before they came out. A mix of folk rock, you know, light rock, jazz, lots of, I guess, inspiration with Boyd and the violin and stuff like that. But it's like, how do you even classify that? Cause he's not playing fiddle really. It's something else. And then they actually did have like some copycats after that. Like you have like your Dispatch and your OAR and the bands that try to kind of follow in those footsteps. So I think that's probably their greatest contribution to music, is that they were so innovative in terms of the blending of the styles, to say nothing of the fact that they're racially integrated band. I mean, there's at the start there were more black dudes than white dudes, and you're talking about Dave Matthews, who came from South Africa and had lived through apartheid and stuff like that. So that was a big I think touchstone of their story back then as well, is that they were just sort of the closest thing you could describe it. I don't even think this term is used anymore, but it's like world music, right? But they used to call like everything that wasn't from America was like world music. And they fit squarely into those categories. Like you could listen to them alongside of, Fela Kuti or King Sunny Ade or something like that.
What I think to that, they like, I know for me personally, I think a lot of people, they introduce people to music that they were not going to check out without the Dave Matthews Band. I mean, there's a similar comp that can be made to a lot of jam bands, just because there is an eclectic aspect to, I'm going to pick a little bit of music from over here and a little bit of music from over here. We're never going to play anything straight ahead, but we're going to do it through this like blended interpretation. But like Dave Matthews Band was, one of the first bands I listened to that had improvisation and had, these like horn sections were like, that was a big feature. And it introduced me to like folk and to rock and, like 60s folk, in terms of like the inspirations that Dave had. So I think that worked really well in the 90s. And it kind of goes back to something that you were saying earlier, Matt, where like this feels, every time I listen to Dave Matthews Band now, and it's why I'm really interested in what we're listening to in the 2000s from them, is everything from the 90s just feels like a 90s stereotype in a lot of ways, in both the best and the worst ways possible.
But I mean, that sound like that in that eclectic mix, I mean, Polestar did something in 2010 of the concert receipts from 2000 through 2009. And Dave Matthews Band was number one, and they sold $530 million in tickets, 11.6 million tickets in that decade. And the top 10 was Dave Matthews Band, then Celine Dion, then Kenny Chesney, then Bruce Springsteen, the Rolling Stones, U2, Madonna, the Eagles, Elton John, Jimmy Buffett, and Britney Spears. I mean, what an incredible achievement for them to be like the highest grossing band of the decade in the 2000s, and having basically like, we can't even classify their music. It's pretty cool. I mean, just because like world music was like, they played it at like coffee shops and like, it wasn't like, it's not like a marketable music, it's incredible.
You could buy
it's wild that like,
yeah, I was just going to say, you could buy their music at the Rainforest Cafe.
Right.
a decade as well that like we've talked about and listeners have commented on was not recognized as their most successful, like to end the 2000s as the number one touring act. I guess it like goes to show that like for every 17-year-old that has the rite of passage, they have a little brother or a little sister who has, you know, friends who have a little brother, a little sister. Like there's always someone to bring along to Dave Matthews to be like, you're not ready for Fish. You're not ready for, you know, these other jam bands, but like, you're ready for this, which like, you know, will give you a sampling of a lot of different music. We'll never rock too hard. And you know, you're going to kind of want to stop with maybe a bit of Boomers, you know, and that'll be it. That'll get you out there.
I could have been your little brother, Brian. I think at this point, the Dave Matthews Band has sold a total of something like 25 or 30 million tickets, you know, throughout their career. So anyway, anyone listening or watching knows that this is a successful band. But Matt, you talked about the 90s nostalgia a little bit. Is there anything in this show that countered that or that stuck out to you that like fell into more of like a, I guess, for lack of a better term, musical appreciation, and not just like, okay, these are songs I heard a lot in the 90s and 2000s.
It may be as simple as that, right? I mean, and once again, this is my personal experience stepping back into listening to this band from long ago. I would probably have completely different feelings if we were listening to a show from, you know, last year or something like that. But going back to that place in time, thinking about this and hearing the audience that is not even ironically or kind of lamely, like super into the show, you can tell this crowd is just amped, man. And I mean, we've all been to Hampton. We know what it's like in that room. And so they're so close to, you know, their kind of home region, basically in their home region here, that, you know, to hear like New Year's Eve, 1996, this crowd going crazy, them playing all of their best material with the Flecktones and with Tim Reynolds. And, you know, I'll try not to keep, you know, making analogies, but this is to me almost like their version of like Fish's 1231-95. Like it's this band that's like on just exploding. I'm not sure if you guys have discussed this in other, you know, volumes, but they like the degree to which they grew over the course of like 2 or 3 years is absolutely insane. I mean, they pretty much literally went from playing like 2000 person rooms to like selling out amphitheaters within the course of a year. That is insane, especially for, you know, once again, a band that we can't really define very well. But that was also kind of the power of like MTV back then. So I'm mentally going back and listening to this show, and it just feels very 1996, you know. It's just very, like very much an anchor of like what was going on in that time. You know, the careless 90s when the economy was great and the, you know, most scandalous thing that happened was that the president got a blowjob from an intern. Like, you know, those nice, happy, carefree days back then. This just kind of does make me feel that way in a good way.
I'm right there with you. I mean, it's wild. Like, you know, you're talking about the nostalgia factor. I'm just thinking like at this point in time, you know, Kurt Cobain's been gone for almost 3 years. Grunge music has essentially been, I mean, pushed aside in terms of the cultural, you know, zeitgeist at the moment. Dave Matthews Band is one of the biggest bands of the mid 1990s here. We've had Woodstock 94 2 years earlier to like revive the 60s spirit. Like Bob Dylan's son put out one of the biggest records of 1996 with the Wallflowers. Like, you know, rap music is at a point where like it's still kind of on the outskirts, but it's about to become like the mainstay of music in, you know, from a pop culture standpoint. I don't even think the Backstreet Boys or NSYNC have put out records by 1996. Like at this point in time, like the music, like the popular music is Dave Matthews Band, which kind of represents in so many ways everything that we thought was like peak Clintonian 90s, where you could have a rock band that isn't really a rock band and plays a lot of different music and has, hey, look, most of us are not just white Americans getting up on stage here. And like, that's something that like can be pushed on kids in a lot of ways, even like in a subliminal way. And you know, you make the comp to like Fish's 1231-95, a ton of people last week when we said that we were doing this episode today commented that like, this is the best Dave Matthews show that the band has ever played. I'd be curious, you know, anybody that's listening, anybody that's hanging out here, like, is there a show that like is unanimously or thought of as better than this? Because that wild comp between this band and Phish is, you know, Phish is playing Madison Square Garden on 12/31/95 when most of the country has no idea who they are. And at this point in time, Dave Matthews Band has put out like a however many times platinum record in Crash just, you know, 8 months earlier.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good show. It's a really good show. I mean, can we talk about the New Year's Eve show generally? Because I think like with some other bands, like, I think there can be pros and cons of New Year's Eve shows. I mean, there's like, sometimes like there's the hype, you know, doesn't live up to the hype. Sometimes it does. This one, that whole set that we started to talk about with the Flecktones, starting with Trippy Billy's and Trippin' Billy's Lionel Gray's number 41, that's a pretty solid set of music. And I feel like for this particular show, this seems like a, I don't know. Well, first of all, do you guys agree with that? That like, a New Year's Eve shows can be like hit or miss, or is that just me being a bad music fan?
They're often like not my, they're definitely not my favorite nights of a run unless it's like an outstanding show. I would prefer, I'm a huge 12:30 fan because like, I like the idea of like a big thing happening right before this supposed huge night. I don't really like New Year's Eve. Like I prefer to just like hang out at home and live stream a show unless I have like tickets to a concert. And I think you hear it often in music that like the excitement factor gets to the artists and kind of like, it's almost like they're over their skis where you're excited to be playing on New Year's Eve. You've got to bring all this energy. And unless whatever magic is in the air to meet the music, it's hard to often deliver like a stellar performance that you would on kind of just like a regular night. I don't know. What are your thoughts, Matt?
Yeah. Putting aside everything in terms of like actual shows that have happened, you know, typical things about, you know, different nights of the run and stuff like that. I love New Year's Eve. I think it's a great night. It's like the best night to see live music. There's like built-in excitement and everybody's super into it. The energy in the room is always great. I'm remembering that when I was collecting DMB tapes back in the day, this was one of those, like, it was like everybody had it. Like everybody had to have this one. And it was in the late 90s, I think, kind of seen as one of, if not their best show ever. And I think that New Year's Eve mystique about it was like one of those things that this happened on New Year's Eve. It was like a later show. They played after midnight, you know, whatnot. And that is actually probably one of the things that got me really excited about eventually getting to see live music on New Year's Eve. Side note, I remember the buzz around this time and the excitement of people, you know, going to see live music over this winter break. I was a freshman in high school when this happened. If you were in Philly, you could have seen Phish two nights in a row and then Dave Matthews Band all at the Spectrum three nights in a row. That was, I remember people coming back from the break and talking about that epicness. I wasn't at the shows, but that's pretty crazy.
Wow. Yeah. So they had a 5-night run, which started in Charleston, then Winston-Salem, then Landover, Maryland at US Air Arena, then the Spectrum, then Hampton. It's a lot of traveling in 5 days for holiday shows, but this seems to be the best of the group for sure. And what do you guys, what should we go into the awards and just talk about the jams?
Let's do that. It is crazy. I'm just noticing. I pulled up the 12/30/96 set list. There's like 10 or 11 repeats from that show to this show. It's the biggest difference is that you don't get, you get Bela Fleck in for part of the latter part of that set, but it's a wild differentiation there that you get like, just here are the big songs. We're going to transfer them over.
And this, I mean, by and large, they weren't performing for like a tour of people who were on tour, right? They were just so. Like, yeah. If you saw that Philly show on the 30th, you were most likely not traveling to Hampton for the show the next night.
Yeah, I think, right? That's a fair assumption.
So the repeats are sort of just part of it. All right, well, we have to talk about some of these jams. I guess first, Brian, as you're going through this 12:31 show, two sets. Are you going to the bathroom at all in this two set show?
I'm gonna wait until the set break. I'm gonna deal with even the satellite rhyme and reason two step is great, but satellite rhyme and reason like would be my preferred bathroom break. But I'm just gonna hang out through it. I figure we've got, you know, 10 songs here to kick off the set, and then we've got 7 songs in the second set. I can handle. Wow. Suffer a little bit towards the end.
Wow, good for you, man. I mean, if it's New Year's Eve, I'm definitely going to be taking a break in the middle of the set because at least I'm going to go get another beer.
What are you taking a break during?
I think during that segment that you pointed out, I think satellite. I'm stepping out for satellite at this point. If I've been to 7 live tracks shows and I've seen 7 satellites, and so I'm good. I'm good. What about you, Matt? Are you breaking at all?
Well, you know, I've got this run in real life where I have not left my seat during a Fish New Year's Eve show since like 2012 or something like that, maybe even 2011. Cause I usually don't drink at the New Year's Eve shows. I don't want to pee. I'm just there for the excitement of whatever happens. In this case, I can definitely stick it out until set break, which is surprising to me because naturally I would have said Satellite as the pee break song. But here's the nostalgia again. I probably hadn't listened to this song in like, you know, 15, 20 years when I listened to it last week. And I was like, oh, it's actually kind of a nice song when you haven't heard it a million times. So I could stick out through that. My pick for the one that I would skip is Minarets. And I was never a fan of this song. It is annoying to me. I did realize while I was listening to this that it would be way better just as an instrumental. There's some really cool parts in there, but Dave's lyrics and singing, it's like getting bashed over the head. And I think at this point we're after midnight. I would probably let myself go out and you know, hit the bathroom for 9 minutes.
A set of Minarets, The Last Stop, What You Are. I'm trying to think, what other Middle Eastern vibe songs does Dave Matthews has he written? There's like this very specific subgenre within Dave Matthews where he's like, I'm writing songs as though I went to Fez for 6 months and just like absorbed culture, and this is what I came back with.
Maybe he did. You don't know. Might have to ask him. Thank you for that honest opinion about Minarets, Matt. That's great. Brian asked me if I was going to be on another recap this week, and I said I'm going to be screaming from the Minarets. I'm going to start using that one more. All right, Brian, what's your MVP of the show?
This kind of wraps around to what we were talking about earlier, but like the Flecktones. I think that the secret MVP of this series that we've listened to thus far is when the band brings a guest on, something really special happens. And I always go back to that Live Tracks one that we listened to, feels like months ago now, but it was like 10 days ago when we were talking through those jams in December of 1998, and what they add to this band, especially in the second set, really hits me. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I think Bela Fleck, you know, there's a couple of these jams I thought were just so beautiful and really just accentuated by him in particular. So I don't know, maybe that's sacrilege, although we've done it a few times in these live tracks. We've had a non DMB member as our MVP, and maybe that's just, it's just how it goes. Everyone's gonna have to just live with it. Matt, what about you?
I don't see how I could ever listen to any DMB show and think that anyone other than Carter Beauford is the MVP. I mean, he's the best musician in the band. In a band full of great musicians, he's the best. He's a legendary drummer, one of the greatest of all time. And I never tire of listening to him. Every single little detail that he has going on in his playing is just, it's remarkable. So Carter now and forever, always.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's totally fair.
Totally. I'm right there with it.
Totally fair. I do want to say that, Brian, the Dave Matthews Band's first show ever, which was on March 14th, 1991, was part of a benefit for the Middle East Children's Alliance at Trax Nightclub. So
this is it.
I just want you to know that there's some connection there. All right.
They
were
born out of the Gulf War, and they held on to this like vibe around the Middle East throughout the 1990s, when none of us were paying attention. They were trying to say, pay attention to this region of the world.
They were. All right, Brian, what's your jam of the show?
I thought hard about this, and I was, you know, part of me was thinking Seek Up, this great opener. Part of me was thinking this fantastic version of number 41, but I just kept coming back to, is this going to be sacrilege I'm about to say? I don't know. But they bring Paul McCandless on to play Crash Into Me. Bela Fleck is out there as well. And the sax solo that we get from McCandless adds so much to this song. And it, to me, as I was thinking, like, this is the end of such a massive year for this band, and this song crashed into me. Like, without this song, what is this band? Like, you probably don't get 5 years later people saying, hey, Dave Matthews, need to write more pop songs. Like, this is the direction your career needs to go. He proved that he could do it with this song. This song was everywhere in the summer of 1996. It's a defining song for this band's career, for better or worse. And this version was absolutely gorgeous. So all that stuff together, it's like, this is a song I'm going to go back to. But I'm guessing you guys are leaning in different directions.
Well, I just want to say Paul McCandless is a native of Indiana, Pennsylvania, which is also the home of IUPUI, right, Matt? Is that that's the college name there in Indiana? I've just been trying to learn as much as I can about these guys. So I think the...
I love states in other states. Yeah, that is a vibe.
I think the Lion Our Graves with Bela is just, it's so great. It's a great... I'm going to go back to this version like multiple times. I just think he had such a beautiful solo, and I love these jams anyway, in any case. And I just listened to the one with Krasno from Alpine Valley like a week ago, and that was really cool. Like you said, Matt, having someone step in and add to that song is great. And in this case, I think Bela Fleck brought it home. It was really, really, really great. Matt, what about you?
I have a surprise selection that I really would not have come to if I not spent, you know, a couple hours like really listening to the show in detail. Normally I would have said number 41, maybe Lie in Our Graves, maybe Seek Up, but probably 41 because it's my favorite of their songs, and they always kind of did the most. It's their Dark Star, or their Tweezer, if you will. Horrible. But I started listening to a song later in the show that I did have kind of the impulse to skip, but I was making myself listen to every single note of the show without skipping. Song that I never liked back then was Typical Situation. And I listened to it, and the jam out of Typical Situation is amazing. Like, closest I've heard them come in this, you know, at least in this show, to actual like band improvisation. Like, they really get out there with the Flecktones and everything. That kind of leads into another sort of, you know, little improv jam after that. And yeah, I was really, really surprised. So I have to give jam of the show to Typical Situation, even though I don't like the song.
Matt is opposed to everybody being happy, everybody being free. He does not want to keep the big door open. He does not want everybody to come around. This was a great version. And there's a killer version in a later volume that we are going to cover. But I think that what you're talking about is like the thing that really blows me away about this show and about this era is looking at Dave Matthews Band just as a whole. Like, I don't expect these types of surprise jams to happen. And then when they do happen, it just elevates a show and elevates a performance, because you're just not expecting it out of songs like this.
Matt, do you want to share your awards category that you created?
I brought his own awards. I love it.
So I really, really tried to, I hope I've done a good job over the past 54 minutes of keeping it positive and not just coming in and being, you know, dunking on DMB, since I am not really a fan anymore, though I would say still a fan of this era. And That is the top three cringiest things in retrospect when, as I listen to this show. And this kind of ties back into the 90s nostalgia. Like, yes, people love Dave Matthews Band. They were huge, but slowly people making fun of them, particularly from like other, actually like a lot of Fish fans and stuff were like really not into them and started kind of, you know, saying shit about them. But taking that perspective, as I look back, you know, 25 years later, there were three things that stuck out to me as just not aging well at all. Number one is Dave's scat singing and his method of banter between songs, which was something that before I was a fan of them, I thought was really stupid. And then I kind of got Dave pilled and I was like into them for a while. And it was like, oh yeah, I love that he, you know, between songs is like, you know, talking like that and you can't quite understand them. And he'd do his big scat singing solos at the end of Crash Into Me or whatever. And like, looking back, like he was not good at that and he should not have been doing that. I mean, like let your killer saxophone player like take another solo instead of doing that. It just, it's very like, this is why people hate this band kind of thing. So I was not into that. Second one, and this relates to my pick about Typical Situation and as a jam of the show and not liking the song, is this like lame 90s like activism worldview of like, hey man, like everybody's gotta like take care of the environment and like be peaceful and stuff like that. And which is like, as we sit here in 2022 with the world burning down around us, is easy to point out as being a little bit soft. But like, that's another one that like, you know, people would make fun of, like, oh, like these hippies at college campuses playing hacky sack and stuff like that. And like, you know, the example that I brought up here is like the movie PCU, right? I mean, this is like right out of PCU. This like, it's a typical situation, man. Like we gotta save the planet, save the whales, dude. And so I don't think that stuff has aged well. And I don't think I'm not just pointing that finger at DMB. I think a lot of bands from that era are guilty of this. And then the last thing that,
well, sorry, before that, can I just say in Dave's defense, yes, that over time he's incredibly out there activist in terms of LGBT causes and Democratic candidates. And he like goes and plays benefits. Unlike some of our other favorite artists, he's out there like wearing his heart on his sleeve and trying to raise money for candidates and causes that he really cares about. So I think you're right, but I think it's cool to me that he has not only like started a foundation and all that stuff, but he's, you know, he's out there like putting himself out there as like, I want to support progressive causes and people who are trying to change things. So I think that's pretty cool.
I agree. I think, I think he's backed up his words over time. I think that like to what you're saying, Matt, I read this article recently called 1989 to 2001, America's Long Lost Weekend. It was a feature in the New Republic about how we missed this great window to actually like continue the reform that had been started in the 1930s and then again in the 1960s and then had been disrupted in the 1980s. And rather than actually doing the hard work and really like taking the political opportunity that we had to drastically change things that now 30 years later look like they were fully preventable and have put us in a really challenging situation, we just didn't. And it's all kind of summarized in, we talked about this last week, the speech that, or the banter that Dave had before Cry Freedom, where he talks about Nelson Mandela being a cool guy. And I was just like, that is such a 1996 mindset where like, as long as we talk about this guy who spent like 30 years in jail for his political beliefs, it's like, oh, he's a cool guy. You should all check him out. Like that is the limit of political activism in the 90s.
And that's an excellent point to be 100% clear. I'm talking strictly about the music and the lyrics, the activism through music, because Dave is one of the probably greatest, you know, musical philanthropist of the last 30 years. He does so much great stuff. So, so we got to talk about, there's a little bit of a problem here, right? And this is the cringiest thing. And I think it's still the cringiest thing. Boyd Tinsley, man, even setting aside his things that he did to get himself kicked out of the band, he just like wasn't good. I mean, like, he's actually, I shouldn't say that. He's a very good musician. And I corrected myself, or at least contradicted myself, when I listened to Before These Crowded Streets after listening to this show. Stuff like, you know, at the beginning of Pig, he plays a beautiful violin line. Stuff that's composed is very, very good. Technically, he's a great violinist. As a fiddle player and as an improviser, it's just not good. I mean, it's like nails on a chalkboard at times when you listen to him just playing the same like double stop over and over and over and over again, just louder and louder during a Lion or Grave solo or something like that. And it's amazing that with the other four guys in the band being so incredible and being so like innovative and creative, that this guy had a place in the band for so long. And maybe that's another 90s thing, you know, maybe that was just like, hey man, we're different. We got this dude with dreadlocks playing the fiddle and a rock band or whatever. But I don't know, it hasn't aged well. And I think most people would probably look at that and see that as the number one strike against them in the larger history of the band.
Yeah. Go ahead, Brent.
I was just going to say quickly that like one of my, when I was thinking about stopping listening to the Dave Matthews Band, and if you want to know anything about me, it's like, I have to go through a process to stop listening to an artist that I really care about. I have to really justify it to myself. Part of it was like the fiddle, like Boyd Tinsley limits this band so much. And I remember getting yelled at in the summer of 2002 by a couple of my very close friends because I had the audacity to say that Boyd Tinsley should be kicked out of Dave Matthews Band. I was ahead of the curve. I knew nothing about the abuse. I knew nothing about like his bus riding performance and his how he acted off stage. I was just like, this guy sucks. I don't like the way that he plays with this band. I don't like the impact that it has to his music. I'm done with the fiddle in the band. Go ahead, RJ.
There's nothing else to say. I appreciate that perspective. All right. So Matt, this has been fun and thank you for coming on. I think you'll be interested in the next set of live releases we're going to be covering starting next week. We're going to announce that on Thursday. We're going to tell everyone what's going to happen next, but Matt, I hope you'll join us again. This has been fun.
I absolutely will. I told you I would be, interested in talking about Dave Matthews Band from the era that I was seeing them or earlier. And, you know, I think the next artist that we're going to talk about is something that I will talk about any year, any show, any day, any time. It's going to be good.
The good, the bad, the religious experiences, the bad, the really bad, but like the awesomely bad. I can't wait. I'm so excited.
We've already given it up. all right. So next time, which is tomorrow, we're going to talk about a 2004 show, Live Tracks 8. And that's going to be fun. That has some piano, which I'm excited about, but, I want to leave everybody with one more Dave Matthews fact, which is amazing. And you guys probably knew this, but I didn't. Do you know that the last seven albums have all been Billboard number one? I didn't know that.
I read that
number two. Wow. And all the seven after that, every single one.
I think before these crowded streets was the first one. And I think that knocked the Titanic soundtrack off of the top spot after it had been there for like 6 months or something like that.
Bastards.
It was huge.
It is crazy that they still have the fan base that will go to a record store, will buy this online the day that these records come out. Like come tomorrow, yeah. I can tell you, away from the world, I have not listened to those records at all. And there is a huge, huge following for it.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to leave it there because we have a lot more Dave Matthews Band music to talk about tomorrow at 12. So we'll be back. And for those of you listening on the podcast, thank you. Share, review, help us reach more people. And until tomorrow. Bye, guys. This is our last
stop. See you guys then.
Say goodbye.
Osiris.